O'Hara. Counsel, you may set up on that matter. And the second matter on the docket is Puckett against Farmers Insurance Exchange. Are counsel here on the Puckett matter? All right. We have read the briefs in these cases. We have gotten into the record. We're familiar with the record and familiar with the facts in the cases. And so if that helps in streamlining your argument, we hope that it does. And we would ask that anyone who has a cell phone or pager turn that off so that we're not bothered during the arguments. There are 15 minutes per side. Yellow light comes on when there are 5 minutes remaining to help you in asking for time to rebut. With that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'm David Migliaccio, representing the appellant, defendant below, Thomas O'Hara. This case is a criminal case in which Mr. O'Hara was convicted of possession of a controlled substance with a sentence enhancer, habitual offender, and was ultimately sentenced to 96 years in prison, which is where he is now. Mr. O'Hara was convicted primarily on the testimony of a confidential informant, Kelly Soleil, and on the wiretap evidence, which is the subject of this case's appeal. He was, I think the evidence of that is the district attorney's statement on opening at trial that the best evidence is the wiretap evidence. So it's not a question of this being a harmless question. This goes straight to the heart of Mr. O'Hara's conviction. The issue then becomes, under federal and state wiretap law, was the application for the wiretap and subsequent applications for the extensions, which incorporated the original application, were those applications sufficient under the federal and state statutory scheme? Specifically, was application made by the elected district attorney? Let's turn to that question for just a moment here. First of all, the record shows that the district attorney did not personally apply. The application, which is the 66-page affidavit, it's a little confusing in the record because that affidavit appears about six times in the record, and it's hard to keep it straight. But what kicked all this off, what kicked the investigation off, was this affidavit of a Drug Enforcement Agency task force officer, Brecklin Burns, her name. Not a member of the district attorney's office, a Drug Enforcement Agency task force officer, or TFO, as I will refer to her, in conjunction with a chief deputy DA, Rubenstein, of Mesa County, who worked in the office of the elected DA, and that would be Peter Hautzinger, whose name does appear once in that 66-page application under the language, this application is being submitted by Peter G. Hautzinger, District Attorney of Mesa County, Deputy District Attorney Rubenstein, and I, and that refers to the task force officer. So all three of them are listed as the people making this application. I think it's important to look at certain parts of the record here because the problem is that when we got to suppression hearing, we find that there's a problem because the elected district attorney did not sign the document, did not sign the application. First of all, there is no separate application. The application, as such, consists of that 66-page affidavit and a small supplemental application that the court required the name of the confidential informant. So we have that application. That application is the one that starts it all off for telephones 1 and 2. Then subsequent applications for telephone 3 and telephone 4 all incorporate that application. To the extent that that application is defective, everything based on it is defective. That's the Giordano case. And Giordano is very close to our case, which I'll get into in a moment here. Look at the way the district attorney's argument, Deputy District Attorney Rubenstein's argument, kind of evolved in this case. He starts off in his initial response, and you'll remember that this started off in Mesa County. That's how Mr. Rubenstein was involved originally, because the original prosecution was in Mesa County. It was moved to El Paso County. That's where the suppression hearing took place. So the initial response, the written response, talks about the initiation of the wiretap by the district attorney's office, that the deputy DA read and personally approved the application. In the second response to the motion to suppress, the deputy DA says something that he continues to insist all the way through the case, which is that he, that is the chief deputy, also has the authority to authorize the application even without the express authorization of the district attorney. This we know from a reading of the law to be incorrect. And it brings us to the question of why there doesn't seem to be a lot of Colorado law on this particular issue. Well, there isn't a lot of Colorado law on this particular issue because as the district, Mr. Rubenstein is, at suppression hearing, he's kind of critical of defense counsel. He says, well, defense counsel is used to the way they do it in El Paso County. How do we do it in El Paso County? The same way it's done in every other county in Colorado. The elected district attorney signs the application, signifying that the application has come before him. It doesn't say that he's reviewed chapter and verse, but it says that he's putting his affirmative signature on it. I'm making this application. That's how it's done in El Paso County. Separate application, affidavit in support. That's how it's done every place else. And because everybody else does it this way, this is really a case that's sui generis because it comes before this court precisely because there is no evidence in the record, none whatsoever, of an affirmative authorization by Mr. Hautzinger himself, the elected district attorney. He's the only one who has the authorization under this statutory scheme.
Counselor, I need to ask you a few questions now.
Certainly.
We have here a federal wiretap statute and a state wiretap statute.
Yes.
And are the provisions, in your view, largely coextensive, largely the same?
I would say coextensive in this sense, that the state statute may not exceed the requirements of, it may not go beyond the requirements of the federal statute.
So the federal statute provides the floor here.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Under the federal statute, of course, we have basically a statute-specific exclusionary rule and allows for suppression on three grounds. As pertinent here, the first would be that the communication was actually unlawfully intercepted.
Yes.
Because it was not authorized by a person who's actually empowered to authorize it.
Correct.
The application was. And second, that the order of approval or authorization is insufficient on its face. Was suppression here sought on which of these two grounds? Or on both?
I would say both.
Okay.
There is a lot of unclarity in that sense because I think the issue evolved. But Mr. O'Hara's original counsel in Mesa County made the first motion to suppress, which was never ruled upon. But it was clear what he was talking about. What he was attacking was the fact that there was no evidence that the elected district attorney had authorized the application, had actually made the application. And I wanted to talk, too, about the question that's raised by the attorney general of whether authorization is the equivalent of making the application for purposes of what the statutory requirements are.
Well, let me ask you this. Why wouldn't the statement by the affiant here, if credited, support a reasonable inference that the elected district attorney ultimately did authorize the application?
We get to that because the elected district attorney did not sign the application.
Correct. So we have problems with spatial insufficiency.
And that's the Smith case and numerous other cases that say the preferred procedure is elected DA signs it. So once we have the elected district attorney not signing it, now we have to inquire deeper than simply the recitation by the task force officer that this application is being submitted by Mr. Hautzinger, his deputy, and I. That is not facially sufficient for one central reason, and that's why I'm getting to the authorization does not necessarily equal application. And the reason is because that goes one way. That's the task force officer simply reciting the elected district attorney's name in the document. That does not reflect any actual action by the district attorney to authorize or to apply. You don't have anything in the record that shows that there was that actual authorization, that there was that action on the part of the district attorney. You have vague statements by Mr. Rubenstein. The district attorney authorized, and note how carefully they danced around this question in the suppression hearing. The district attorney authorized the staffing levels for this investigation. Nowhere. Look at what the cases require. The vast majority of the cases that deal with this issue, the federal cases, say you need writing. The attorney general, in her brief, admits that the standard is the Gianelli standard, that you need something in writing from the district attorney showing that he in fact authorized this.
Counsel, with respect, I think you are sort of conflating the analysis here, and so I want to separate them out again. This wiretap is illegal. The communications were unlawfully intercepted if the application was not in fact approved by the district attorney.
Correct.
So you will agree with me, I hope, that on that first question, your issue rises or falls on whether the evidence before the trial court would support a reasonable conclusion, a reasonable inference that the district attorney in fact ultimately did authorize. Okay.
I would agree with that.
Then there's a whole separate question about whether the documents are facially insufficient because they were never signed by the district attorney. And that kind of error could be, of course, overcome if it turns out to be merely one in which the proper people didn't make the right signatures, but ultimately the underlying procedure was nevertheless valid.
Agree with that.
Okay, so let's talk about that first point. The presence or absence of the district attorney's signature isn't the deal breaker. The question is, what's before the court that will support a conclusion that the district attorney did or didn't actually authorize?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's where we look at the continued insistence. Why would, if the deputy district attorney had put the application in front of Mr. Hautzinger and said, here, and by the way, not just the application, but all subsequent applications too. Sure, they're the first one, but the subsequent ones all incorporate the first one. And the law is, look at the Giordano case is very close to our case for that reason, because in the Giordano case, appropriate official did not authorize the initial application, but did properly authorize the extensions, and the Supreme Court threw them all out. Said, no, the initial wiretap was not proper because the executive assistant of the Attorney General was the one who did the authorization. Look at the continued insistence of Mr. Rubenstein. I have the authority alone. Why would he say that? Why would he continue to insist that in writing at the hearing? Either he doesn't know the law, which leads again to the inference that he did not comply with the law, or he does know the law, in which case he knows that all he has to do is be able to stand up and say, yes, we put these applications, not the investigation, not some vague knowledge of the investigation, we put these applications in front of the elected district attorney who specifically approved them. That's all he had to say, and then we wouldn't have needed 88 pages of suppression hearing dancing around the issue. If I may, I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
All right, Mr. Miliaccio, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. It appears to me as if the issues that were raised by the defendant in the opening brief regarding lack of signature, lack of separate application, this has seemed to have boiled down to an acknowledgement that the issue here is whether or not the initial application was in fact authorized by Mr. Hautzinger. And the defendant argues that there's actually no evidence in the record whatsoever to support the court's finding and support the idea that the initial application was in fact authorized by Mr. Hautzinger. Basically, the case law the case law that recognizes that actual authorization is important certainly recognizes certain ways, and in those cases, there are certain ways in which actual authorization can be shown. It can be by signature, by affidavit of either the district attorney or the deputy DA explaining how that they how the elected DA authorized it, memos, initialization of documents, that kind of thing. But it's important to note in the statute itself, it does not prescribe any particular way in which that actual authorization must be shown. So I think the issue here is whether there simply is any evidence in the record that the Mr. Hunsinger actually authorized this application. And I think there's ample evidence, and I'd like to go through that, because I think it's much more than just the assertion in the application itself that the application is being submitted by Mr. Hunsinger.
Ms. Hansen, let me just ask you before you get into that, is there a particular burden that must be met? Is it just a showing? Is an offer, you know, would an offer proof that so-and-so said something is sufficient? Do they need to have actual testimony by the DA?
Well, I'm sorry. I think basically what, first of all, I think it's important to note, as I noted in my brief, that the burden is on the defendant to establish that the wiretap was invalid. And so we don't have any cases in Colorado certainly establishing exactly how that must happen, whether it must be by evidence or offer of proof. And certainly in other areas such as 404B evidence, they allow offers of proof to establish things like that. I think when we're concerned here with the issue of whether there was in fact authorization, the court can consider anything before it. The court can consider the documents, can consider the testimony, which we have here, can consider the offer of proof, which in this case, I must note that the Deputy DA Rubenstein wanted to testify about the procedure he used, and he discusses, and that's one of my the facts in the offer of proof made that was made by the sounds like co-chair or co-counsel about what Deputy DA Rubenstein would testify to. He said Deputy DA Rubenstein would testify to the procedures used involving himself and Mr. Hunsinger in deciding whether to go for a wiretap and in authorizing the wiretap. So Deputy DA Rubenstein wanted to testify. There was an offer of proof as to what he would testify to. They didn't go into specifically exactly what details, when they sat down, what they showed him, that kind of thing. But they wanted to testify about those procedures. Within that offer of proof is an assertion that this was, in fact, authorized by the deputy, by the elected district attorney.
Well, Ms. Hansen, that doesn't go much further than the statement by the task force officer, where he said that the affidavit was sufficient because it said, quote, application for this order is being submitted by Peter G. Hunsinger, district attorney for the 21st Judicial District, State of Colorado, his appointed deputy attorney, Daniel P. Rubenstein, and I. And I think that Mr. Migliaccio's argument is, all that is a recitation of the DA's name saying that he authorized this, but there are no facts sworn to that would indicate how he supervised or authorized the application.
I guess my comment was in response to Judge Lichtenstein's question about whether it needs to be by offer of proof evidence. And my point was that the offer of proof would have gone into this. The testimony would have gone into this, but the defendant objected.
But the offer of proof doesn't say anything other than that. That's my point.
I believe the offer of proof specifically asserts that the district attorney authorized the application. But I think what you need to look at is all of this information. You have the statement in the affidavit. You have the statements by the DA in the offer of proof. And I believe she did indicate that testimony from Deputy DA Rubenstein would have supplemented the testimony by Ms. the TFO. But even if that's not enough, let's look at the TFO testimony, because I think it's more than just the statement in the affidavit indicating that this application is being made by the elected DA. First of all, on page 31 of the testimony, she's asked, the TFO is asked, when you drafted these documents, did you put anything indicated who had authorized that? So there she's specifically identifying the comment she made on paragraph 2, page 2, saying who authorized the application. So that gets you past the idea that statement in the application is just merely saying who it's on behalf of. She's flat out saying who authorized it. And then you go farther into her testimony on page 32, and she quotes the statement from the application in paragraph 2, and says she swore to that under oath, and to the best of her knowledge, that was accurate information. So she's reaffirming what she'd previously said. He had authorized that. Then if you go further into her testimony, they ask, again on page 32, were there things that occurred after that that would corroborate to you in your mind that it was in fact with the knowledge and authorization of the elected district attorney? So the question is, what made you understand, were there things that corroborated your previous two assertions in this testimony that it was in fact the elected DA who authorized that? And then she goes on to discuss certain things that happened that she believes corroborates that. Certainly she doesn't limit her belief that it was authorized by the DA to these things, but she's asserted numerous times in her testimony that it was in fact the district attorney, the elected DA, that authorized this application.
Well, I do have a question there. Mm-hmm. All right, so what we have is a presumed validity of the application, mm-hmm. that it was authorized, and that is by the statement of the task force officer that it is her belief that the district attorney authorized, mm-hmm. it. Then defendant came forward with a showing that perhaps this is not valid because there's no signature by the district attorney. All right, because there was a showing, prima facie evidence, that it may not be valid. So then the burden is back on the prosecution to show it is in fact valid with something beyond the information we already have. And the information we already have is the task force officers representing that the district attorney authorized it. So what information beyond that was presented that would be sufficient to show that the district attorney authorized?
Well, I guess I'd first like to go back, and I would respectfully disagree that the defendant did anything to establish any prima facie showing that the DA had not in fact authorized this. There's scores of cases, many of which I cited in my brief, that do indicate a signature is not required, that all that's important is actual authorization. You see that in cases dealing specifically with a challenge to a lack of signature, telephone authorization is apparently a common practice and it's been approved. So I don't think the simple lack of signature, which is not at all required by law, there's nothing in the statute that requires a signature. So the lack of signature itself, I don't think establishes in any case that he's established any sort of prima facie showing that it wasn't in fact authorized. It is his burden to affirmatively demonstrate that this wiretap was invalid. He has to demonstrate that it was not in fact authorized. Not only did he fail to do that, as I've indicated, there's plenty of evidence by way of the statement in the affidavit itself, the testimony I've discussed of the TFO, the offer of proof by the deputy DA, which again was strenuously objected to. The defendant tried to keep out that testimony. And then I think if you look at the arguments by the deputy DA in dealing with this motion, he stated four times on pages 85 and 88, this was in fact authorized by DA Hutzinger. He stated that unequivocally. There's been absolutely no evidence whatsoever that this was not done, that any of these affirmations by testimony, by affidavit, by offer of proof, or by argument, that they were in fact not true. And so I think we have, through all four of those avenues, indication, evidence, sufficient support for the idea that that DA Hutzinger personally approved this application.
Counsel, let me ask you a couple of questions that I asked your colleague here.
Okay.
First of all, do you believe that the state statute differs in any way from the federal law, from the federal statute?
Except for the suppression provision. I do believe that the suppression provision in subsection 10 in our statute, or the remedy provision I suggest, is worded differently. I think the requirements of the elected official, the requirements of what needs to be in the application, those things are substantially the same. I don't see any significant difference.
Tell me a little bit about the perceived difference on the remedy.
I believe, and I think I talked about this in a footnote in my brief, I believe that the remedy in the federal statute is kind of it's kind of like the statute in the parental presence provision in our statutes with the juvenile parental presence, where it's a specific exclusion. It says no evidence will be admitted unless you comply. So it requires at the outset that a showing of compliance before any evidence can be included. Whereas our statute simply says, if any there's any violations, essentially, he may move to suppress. And so I do think, certainly there's no question the wording is different. The question is, I guess, in my mind, in your minds, whether that's a difference. And I believe it is.
Do you agree that the local law enforcement officers must meet the federal statute standards as well?
Well, I believe that, yes. I mean, I certainly believe that the state statute cannot provide less protection, but I don't believe it does in terms of the protections afforded to the procedures required. And I don't think this remedy necessarily provides anything more or less. I think it's just it's an automatic, perhaps it deals more with the burden of proof. But I do think, and as I pointed out in my brief, the difference where that comes into play, the remedy provision is not, I mean, if we have a violation, we have a violation. If there was no actual authorization, arguably there's a violation. What I raise that suppression, the remedy issue, is in the event that this court determines that the lack of signature or the lack of separate application constitutes a technical violation. I don't believe it does. I don't, as I argued in my brief, I don't believe that the statute requires any of those things. But to the extent that this court determined that they do, they're technical violations because the issue is actual authorization. And the Chavez court specifically distinguished from Giordano the idea that an actual substantive violation warrants the remedy in subsection 10, where as a technical violation that doesn't affect the purpose of the statute, which in this case is the accountability and the centralization issues required by the elected official requirement. If you have actual authorization, remedy of suppression is not going to be warranted.
Two very fact-specific questions. First, in your view, was suppression sought on the ground that the communication was actually unlawfully intercepted, or on the ground that the application was insufficient on its face, or both?
You know, I think that the way the arguments developed, and even through, I think, at least the opening brief here, is they intertwine both. I think they didn't address really until the reply brief whether actual authorization was important. They really relied on the lack of signature, the lack of separate application, all of these kind of on its face issues. And I think I've argued that those are just simply not required. And so I think the only issue here could be whether it was in fact unlawful. And I think that's where we are now.
Okay.
But I don't think that that's how it was presented pretty much until my answer brief.
Second question, and I'm sorry for monopolizing the time here, has to do with the extensions. Mm-hmm. Could you address those?
Absolutely. And I'm happy, I was planning to do that because I do believe that the issue of the validity of the extensions and whether they were authorized by the DA was not raised in on appeal until the reply brief. I note going through the motions that there was some reference to the extensions not being signed, or the extensions not being authorized. There were very brief references. And in fact, if you look at the arguments at the suppression hearing, at the beginning of the argument, the defense attorney actually says, the Milnes case has to be the DA, and there's no doubt to make the initial application. Phone or extension of that wiretap may be made by the ADA, I'm sorry, but the initial application. So he's almost conceding at the beginning of the argument the extensions don't have to be authorized personally. And then towards the end of the argument, he makes a very brief comment about the extensions have to be authorized by the DA. So it's hard to say. The trial court did seem to make a ruling based on Milnes that the extensions did not need to be authorized. But I think regardless of whether it was properly raised below, it was not raised until the reply brief. There's nothing in the opening brief or the supplemental opening brief arguing that the extensions were not properly authorized. And I would just ask for maybe two brief more minutes, since this was an issue that was raised for the first time in the reply brief, to make a couple comments about the extensions.
We'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you very much. Basically, again, I don't think this court should reach it under Chemerinsky and many other cases. The issues raised for the first time in the reply brief should not be addressed. I think if you look at the burden on the defendant to establish the invalidity of the
wiretap. He certainly has that burden as to the invalidity of any of the wiretap applications that he's challenging, and he didn't elicit anything, no discussion whatsoever, no testimony regarding the extension applications. He didn't elicit that, and it's his burden to establish that those were not, in fact, authorized as well. I think in this case, and briefly, factually, I do think there was a brief reference in the TFO's testimony on page 34 indicating that the same procedures were used for the additional applications. So the prosecution did elicit some brief testimony about that, which was not challenged by the defendant. But I would like to note, I question, though, whether, as the trial court did, but for different reasons, whether the statute actually requires the elected official to authorize the extension applications. And the reason I do that, and the trial court initially said it's not required because Milne was decided under 3924.2. Well, I looked at 3924.2, and the language, unfortunately for me, is about the same. So I'm not sure the trial court's distinction was necessarily groundbreaking. But I do believe if you look at the statute, both the federal statute and the state statute, which on this point are exactly the same, subsection 6 in our statute talks about extensions. 2F doesn't really describe the process of getting extensions. Subsection 6 describes the actual process of getting extensions, and it says applications for extension need to be made in compliance with subsection 2. Well, the elected official requirement is in subsection 1. And so when you're talking about applications for extension, it incorporates the requirements in 2, such as it has to be in writing, it has to state probable cause, all of those requirements. But it doesn't, subsection 6 specifically does not incorporate subsection 1. It just subsection 2. And so I think that demonstrates that by the plain language of the statute, the applications for extension do not necessarily need to be made by the elected official. And I would argue that that interpretation of the statute is consistent with the purpose we already have of the elected official requirement. We already have centralization in terms of the initial application. And in this case, we also have the fact that each of the additional applications incorporate by reference the initial one. But centralization and accountability are not furthered by requiring the DA then every 30 days to personally be involved in the application process for extension.
I do just have one brief question. You've mentioned Milnes a couple times, and I just wanted your position on this, because Milnes says there's no doubt the district attorney must personally initiate the wiretap, and that the legislature made the requirement as to the original application. So does that mean that the DA must personally apply for the original application?
Well, it says that the elected DA must personally initiate the original, and it actually says that the elected DA must personally apply for the extensions. So I think I'm fine with the first proposition. I actually disagree with the second proposition, because the only citation they cite for that purpose is subsection 6. And in that situation, like I've said, they only have incorporated the requirements of subsection 2. It doesn't appear that they didn't make a big deal out of it. It means they didn't. For all we know, it just wasn't an issue that was challenged, this distinction between the two. Thank you for the additional time, Your Honors.
Mr. Migliaccio, you can also have a couple of extra minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's start with the question of whether the reply brief was the first place that the extensions were raised. They were raised in the supplemental brief. The supplemental brief, and this may have been my error, but I treated it as a Rule 28 supplement, that I'm allowed to raise facts, I'm allowed to cite law, but I'm not allowed to make additional argument. As the court will see from the record of this case, the opening brief is now almost 2 years old. And then there was extension after extension after extension after extension. So at some point, we discovered that the supplemental record, which consists of all the search warrant and all the wiretap evidence, was in Mesa County, and we got that certified as a supplemental record. And then I made my supplemental brief, which clearly does raise the issue of the extensions. As to what Milne says, well, Milne clearly says, yes, the DA must initiate the wiretap he must initiate the extensions.
Counsel, let me ask you about this point. This can't be the first time it's been raised in the country. What do the federal cases hold on whether the denominated officials must authorize the extension?
Absolutely. The federal cases say it must be the elected district attorney, and here's why. Because you need, first of all, centralized decision-making, and that appears over and over and over and over in the federal cases. You also need, and this is the most important thing, accountability in an elected official. That is so clear. Look at the Olander line of cases that I cited in my briefs, where the Kansas, the district attorney in Kansas decided that, they apparently decided that, again, it was okay for a deputy to do it. And they got, they learned that it was not okay for a deputy to do it. The statute is clear. The federal statute is clear. The state statute is clear. And look, the reason is because if you look at the state statute the way it's now written, and it has changed since we started this case, the state statute now says that the deputy district attorney may be designated if the elected official is out of the jurisdiction. Well, that's critical, because that shows you that the legislature in this state clearly intended that it be no one other than the elected district attorney. For centralization, for accountability, these things are critical. Let's take a quick look at Judge Colt's order of May 31st, 2007, denying the motions to suppress. Again, he cites this vague language. The elected district attorney was involved with the investigation and the application, he finds. Involved with is not the same as specific approval or specific initiation of the application, and we keep focusing on the application. Again, he makes a straightforward legal error. There is no question that his construction of Milnes is incorrect. Milnes says the DA must apply for the must make the application, must initiate the application and any applications for extensions. Then Milnes goes on and is ultimately decided on the question of whether whether some supplemental applications need to be personally authorized, and it finds that it does not. But for extensions and for the initial application, Milnes is crystal clear, and I would contend that it does actually control this case. Looking at the vagueness of this situation, let's remember that the federal cases that talk about this say this is a search and seizure, it's a violation of privacy, it needs strict scrutiny. It will not do to look at this vague mishmash of facts, of testimony, of offers of proof, and say it's enough. It's enough to sanction this violation of privacy. That is not enough. How will Mr. Hautzinger be held accountable if something goes wrong with this investigation? All we have is the task force officer invoked his name. We have no specific testimony. We have no signature. We have, and some of the federal cases that you talked about, Judge Russell, those federal cases include the fact that in the application, there's an indication of how it was authorized. There's nothing like that here. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Your arguments were very helpful.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.